Welcome to the Sounds of Success, brought to you by the National Association of Professional Martial Artists. This audio magazine is a tool for generating profitable ideas and for taking your business to new levels of excellence and performance. Here you'll find real-life case studies of school owners just like you who have applied our proven successful business and marketing principles to their school and are creating the business of their dreams as a result.
Good morning, Stephen Oliver here, CEO of National Association of Professional Martial Artists and CEO of Mile High Karate, and I'm thrilled and pleased to have great Grandmaster Jun Ri, Father of American Taekwondo, on the line with us. Grandmaster Ri, welcome today.
Thank you for inviting me for this interview.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. It's certainly my pleasure. Grandmaster Ri, one of my favorite Jun Ri quotes, if you will, and hopefully I'm not going to butcher it, is... One that I remember from many years ago, you said, martial arts without philosophy is just street fighting. Would you elaborate on that? Why would you have said something so contradictory to the current MMA trend, at least in martial arts?
Well, fighting itself is a really, opposite to our purpose of life. You know, when you love, you are happy. When you fight, you're very unhappy, really. And so when you fight without really purpose justified, just street fighting, just for the fun of it, people fighting. And so when we have to have a justified reason to fight, self-defense or something.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And now, since the 60s, I mean, you have probably been responsible for hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people training in martial arts. And I certainly know that one of the reasons for that has been an emphasis on something beyond the physical. How did you get started on that path, if I might ask? I know you came to the U.S. in the 50s and started commercial schools in the D.C. area in the early 60s. How did the path turn from the physical to personal development? Was it that way as you trained in Korea, or was that something that you evolved with here?
Not really. When I first came to U.S., I always been very a prudent person to my responsibility. But when I first got a job to teach members of U.S. Congress, which is May 6, 1965. At that time, I really had some feeling that I had some mission that God has given to me. And ever since then I said I'm going to have to really live my life really as honest I can and to lead by example ever since. And
yeah.
So in the result, when I first... also opened the school, I wrote letters to most Western ambassadors. Then, if you send your children to my school, I will guarantee that they will make A's and B students, and also they will behave better. And sure enough, they sent their children. And I got a good result because they don't make a black belt unless they make A's and B students.
Yeah.
All these things put together, I committed myself to really using Taekwondo to really help our society.
Yeah.
Worldwide. And that's how, when they finished their mission and they go back to their country. And many of them asked me to... share my instructors. I didn't have enough, so I introduced every one of them to Korea Taekwondo Association. That's how we made today 197 countries, and there are about estimated 60 million Taekwondo practitioners in this globe.
60 million, that's a phenomenal number. And certainly Taekwondo is the most practiced martial arts in the world at this point. Going back to, I think a lot of people miss the fact, and of course I was there intimately involved with it, but when you first started doing the A and B students, that you had to be at least a B average to get a black belt, promising people that their kids would behave better from martial arts. It wasn't a time when kids typically took martial arts. It was long before Karate Kid 1 and all of the transition into the kids market. How did you end up focusing on that market as opposed to just what everybody else was teaching was 20 to 30 year old adults, mostly males?
Well, I really thought, you know, at that time already I was really into changing the world. And, you know, the world, we have to really target the children, because the reason children are bad is because the leaders are not good. Parents, teachers, and political, religious leaders, many of them just talk. And so I thought we martial art must have some mission. Also, our social problem is violence. And who could handle the violence better than martial artists?
Yeah.
That's why I think God gave us the vision to do, to reshape the, you know, human society.
Back in the 60s is really when you started first expanding, first one school and then multiple schools in Washington, D.C. Where did you come up with the vision to do that? I mean, it certainly was not, I don't think you had any models that had done that. What gave you the mission?
Yeah, the reason was I had such a tough life in Korea. When I came to America, golly, I remember that, you know, until yesterday I was living in a really literally hell, Korea, the poorest country in the world. And then all of a sudden in 24 hours I was transferred to really paradise, the United States of America. And I started thinking, you know, what makes such a, you know, vast country in two nations? And I really searched, you know, what's the really root strength of America. And I found that American founding fathers, you know, mission statement to build a great country was not just for America, but the entire human race. And there, you know, America has been blessed by God, an unselfish, attitude toward the entire humanity.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And what year was it you first started expanding your schools in Washington and developing quite a following there?
In 1962, I started in June 28, 1962. In 5 years, I already had five schools expanded. That's a little bit slower than Steve Oliver. And, at that time, I was giving, you know, motivational speeches in each graduation, session, and that was a perfect ground for me to really practice my public speaking. And that's how I think I have really improved on how to speak in publicly.
Yeah, of course, quite a number of presentations over the years, because you were doing testings every month across 5 and 7 and 10 and 12 or 13 or more locations. So that is quite the public speaking experience, isn't it?
Yeah. I remember when you were 10 years old, you started the Greg Boulder.
Yep.
And you told me you're going to go to Denver in open school. And when you were 10 years old, you told me that. Well, you sure opened many schools there.
Yeah. I'm not sure I would have done it quite the way I did it, but it's worked out okay so far, I guess. So yeah, let's go back to actually integrating, because, again, you led the field with this in the 60s and early 70s. How did you really stumble across integrating the character development with martial arts classes? And what were the early ways of integrating that, and what do you see works best now?
Well, I knew, you know, when I targeted the children, I knew what parents love to see in the children's character development more than really punching and kicking. So unless we really help them, what parents really like to see their children improving, and we wouldn't be business. So I started making a requirement for the B average and above and also, you know, listening to their parents behaving in school and teachers, and parents in home. And so we've been really successful, and I've been, and then in 1982, when Praise Magazine did, you know, children make a better grade, it was a Jun Li Taekwondo. At Parade, spread the idea entire country, all the martial artists, teachers. And that time, not only Taekwondo, but Kung Fu instructors really adopted that policy, made, you know, public image. And also, they, see, I started teaching Taekwondo, members of U.S. Congress, and you know, I didn't charge money. And whenever they say, "Why don't you charge?" I say, "Well, I think if you tell how great the Taekwondo is for children's discipline, whenever you have interviews and papers, radio, television, I think that's better pay for me than really getting money from you."
And absolutely.
Many members of Congress are really supported of that.
It's in a lot of the Parade magazine was at the time, I think perhaps still is, the most widely distributed magazine in the world.
Yeah, that time I think was 30 million circulation.
Yeah, I had first time, actually, I was surprised, but finally met Walter Anderson at your event with the recognition for having taught in Congress for so many years.
Yeah,
so,
he came all the way to Congress to participate in that party.
Exactly. And he's retired now, but he was the publisher of that. And is he a black belt of yours as well?
No, he's not.
Yeah, but you've had many very, very well-known black belts over the years. Tell us a little bit about working with Muhammad Ali and how that came about.
Yeah, Muhammad Ali was supposed to be fighting against his wrestler, Antonio Inoki, 1976, and exactly June 26 in Tokyo, Japan. And one of his friends used to carry my... his name is Norman Kung Fu, and he introduced me to Muhammad Ali to teach him how to block and some kicks, how I started connecting with him. And in fact, I told him, before that Japanese wrestler's fight, there was Richard Dunn, British champions, you know, title match with Muhammad Ali, and he punched him, and when he knocked him out, he told everybody that's the match to June, this acupunch, and at the ring, and the entire world heard that. So that really, those things really maintained the dignity of Taekwondo. Congress, Muhammad Ali, and Bruce Lee's, you know, how to kick the Taekwondo way, although I got some idea from punching from Bruce Lee, and so I exchanged the idea.
You know, and I think a lot of people don't realize it, but Bruce Lee was very aligned with you, was he not, with the philosophical underpinnings of martial arts and expanding it beyond just being a physical activity?
Yes, he is a philosophy major in the University of Washington.
Yeah.
Very philosophy.
I know that one of his favorites was Krishnamurti at the time, and certainly his unfinished manuscripts were just laced with philosophical underpinnings of both the physical and the intellectual.
Yeah, he is a really, really smart, intelligent, and capable young man. Really, I miss him very much.
Yeah, absolutely. Since then, I mean, you've had quite the quite the interesting group of students. How did you end up teaching Tony Robbins and helping him develop to be a black belt of yours?
Oh, yeah. I attended one of his seminars. And then, when he, I answered a few, questions. And then he invited to have a lunch with him. And I talked to him, and of course I was introduced as a Taekwondo master. But he was really kind of interesting, and so I offered my teaching, and he accepted it. So ever since then, he became my best friend, and he was very, really moved by my. So he talked about his session, his lecture in his seminar a lot, and a lot of people tell me that.
Yeah, I've heard that myself, and of course he recognized you in the I think his second book, Awaken the Giant Within, and
right.
And many times on video and audio recordings, I know some of the material that we have with NAMNA, he starts by recognizing your contribution to his life, which is quite impressive. But so over the years is. I mean, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of students have gone through your direct or affiliated schools. I'm sure you don't have a number either, but many. But when you first introduced the getting a B average or better in the character development with the kids, I'm sure it was rather controversial among many in the martial arts community. Probably controversial among some of your students. How? Tell us a little bit about that. Was there some pushback, or was there pretty wide acceptance?
No, if I am asking, you have to be average students to accept it, then that's one thing. But I am saying before you become black belt, you have about 2-3 years to really prepare that. The parents loved it. A lot of people think, how many people can make A's and B's? If I require the prerequisite to come to my school, then that would be a big problem. I wouldn't have any market. But we accept everybody so that they can improve before they become A's and B's. Before they qualify for black belt testing, they have to study. That's how I was very successful with that policy.
Yeah, I'm sure the parents loved it. Along the way, one of the things that I think I mentioned this to you before, but I used to have the collection of Black Belt magazines and Karate Illustrated and so forth, going back to when they were first published, and somehow along the line that collection got dissipated. I think they were walked off with from one of our offices, but. I remember back in the 60s, and this was, I started with you in 1969, but even before, before I started training and I was young then, I remember there was quite the controversy in the industry, and not too different from the day, but there were cover stories, and you were the Pied Piper of Taekwondo, and then there'd be a counterpoint, the case against commercialism, and something that I said to a group recently, I said, it's really fascinating. Because the voices for expanding martial arts and the voices for commercialism in the 60s and 70s are now the legends of the industry. And the ones who are rebelling against that are, nobody knows who they are. And they faded into oblivion. Can you give us a sense of what that was like early on? Because certainly, now there are still schools and teachers who kind of rebel. But mostly it's accepted that there are high-quality professional schools, but then it wasn't accepted. I know certainly my experience in Washington, D.C. is many of the other schools and school owners weren't real fond of us.
Well, I didn't have any really problem. Really, whenever they ask, I answer straightforward, my reasoning. A lot of people, many martial art instructors have been influenced by the Asian instructors that charging money teaching martial art is evil. And I said that's nonsense because, whenever you have value, you charge money to really give better services to your students. And that's why even church, you know, they collect the money. So I tell, you know, those who say proudly, I teach for nothing. Well, you what do you think you're teaching values? Nothing? Well, you value something. Well, if you value something, then you should charge it. But you justify. Otherwise, people will think that's nothing.
Yep.
And so you are defeating, really, demoting the value of martial arts by teaching free. And so I really started my school commercially from the first day. And I have been really successful. That time I didn't have this bigger, you know, picture as I have, but time goes, you know, just life begins, grow, and the idea grows. And so from small ideas, and I want to go to U.S., teach martial art, to really make my living better than I was in Korea. And that when that is realized, and then my goal became bigger and bigger and bigger now, my goal is to making everybody in this planet happy with every breath of life. And I really promise you that my feeling is that within 21st century, the Trutopia will be realized.
Absolutely, absolutely. And let's transition to your book. You know, clearly the principles and philosophies that you teach are perfectly in sync with martial arts instruction and with the environment that we create. And I think, truthfully, anybody who doesn't believe that they're in sync does themselves a disfavor from two sides. One is they sink back to your previous quote of martial arts without philosophy is street fighting. But the second thing they do is they greatly undervalue and devalue what it is we can accomplish. But let's tell everybody a little bit about your book. How did it come into to being? It's called Trutopia. So what was the genesis and the evolution of your new book?
Well, you know, first, you know, about 30-some years ago, I thought I was going to title the book Common Sense. Universal Common Sense. And then it evolved to be True Utopia, because Utopia is really coined by Thomas More as, I think, 1516, and a fictitious island in Atlantic Ocean. Idealistic community, but it's impossible to really achieve. But I am saying, I'm reversing the history. Yes, it is possible to really create the perfect community. It's not only in one community, an island, but entire globe is supposed to be Garden of Eden and children of God's dwelling place. I mean, what else God would expect for his children to live? Happy life or miserable life that we are living in? And so I knew that something, this world is something very wrong. And I really searched the cause of this really troubled world. There is one cause. It's not because we don't believe in God. Only cause of this problem is deception, deceiving each other. And deceiving each other, you know, really became distrust among the people. So between the nations, they start building the wall. But it didn't help because within the country, they have to have a police. So they are among the same people, they are cheating one another. And then they had to have, you know, the religion to really teach them. And they have to have a martial art to really defend themselves against another fellow man. Instead of love, we have to fight. And so can you imagine how much really we are wasting by destroying each other? We have something like a little over 14 trillion deficit in this country now, and we are in really big trouble right now. But that mostly caused by the last 10 years of war Iraq and war and Taliban. And I said, if I divided, you know, $15 trillion by 300 million population, that means one each person owe about, government owe to the each American people of almost $500,000. That's a lot of money.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And I really do not know how it's going to be recovered, but I'm sure the Creator will have some idea to help if we do our share of our responsibilities.
Hey, I had the great privilege of accompanying your niece, Helen Chung, and her daughter is at the Air Force Academy, and they had a marvelous little ceremony. They go from basic training into being accepted in as a freshman. I took my 10-year-old daughter, Jada, down, and very impressive, but one of the things that what you just said brings to mind, Grandmaster Rhee, is there's a new rating on colleges in the U.S., and West Point is rated now number 4 in the U.S., Air Force Academy, I think, number 7, but they're distinguished from the others by the underlying expectation of leadership and character development. And as we walked into the campus with Sophie, engraved in marble is the creed there, which is, I shall not lie, cheat, or steal, nor tolerate those who do. And, of course, one of the values that West Point and the Air Force Academy in Annapolis are teaching is that unshakable character and unshakable honesty. It seems like it ties perfectly both in martial arts school training, but also with your philosophies.
Yes, really, I'm glad in a way that there's only one rabbit to catch, the deception. There's not many cause of all this problem in this world. There's only one cause. If everybody become divine human character, never lie, then we don't need religion. We don't need we need a religion today. Don't misunderstand. And when everybody become divine human character, we don't need the martial art fighting, the martial ballet we need for exercise. And that's why I changed from fighting, you know, martial ballet almost 40 years ago. And so I really do think that martial art has a mission to really reshape this human society to be what it is originally that God has designed for his children's happy living.
Yeah, absolutely. You touched upon something, but let's go back to martial ballet. The genesis of that was what? How did you get the idea of that? And is it true that the first time that was performed was in the movie? Or I remember two stories. One is in Minneapolis by the Whirlies, and one story was in Sting of the Dragon Masters or When Taekwondo Strikes. What was the genesis of the first musical form that you did?
Well, you know, I lived really to build this utopian society, and I did the martial art too. For martial art is the really means of reaching that goal. And so, if you remember, Might for Right. That's my narration on Might for Right is from Genesis to Revelation, and in 2 minutes and 18 seconds, the theme song of Exodus, and that is really really coincided with what I have been teaching.
Yeah.
And then how this world became so really unimaginable, you know, place to live, to we have to really change from here to really where everybody can be really enjoy this world as God has designed for us.
Mm-hmm. And as you evolved into musical forms, which of course now permeates the martial arts scene, and you know, one of the most recent iterations is Mike Chat, who's a great guy, but his XMA thing. But it began to permeate, probably led off by, I remember seeing you perform in the cutoff pants and the chains from the movie and at Mike Anderson's tournament in St. Louis. I think it was the same tournament. And we have Jeff Smith on the line, but I think he's permanently muted here, which we'll try to include him in. But I remember seeing that performance at Mike Anderson's tournament. And then, of course, your student John Chung traveling the country after that. What do you think was the genesis to get widespread acceptance of that from the martial arts community?
Well, after that, you know, the Exodus is the first one I choreographed. Then I said, you know, between the nations, if we want to promote peace, we got to make a national anthem, martial ballet. So when American goes to Russia to do the Russian martial art ballet, they loved it. And when Russian came to America, they did the American national anthem. And these activities really promote the peace among people. So everything that I did is really to promote the peace among people, among the nations, among the, you know, organizations. And everything is really congruent with what I did, I hope, in the eyes of the people.
You bet. You bet. Tell us about the evolution and creation of safety equipment. I know that perhaps part of the or a big part of it was Pat Worley being injured pretty seriously. But how did that come about?
Yeah, when Pat Worley was injured, and I was in a point of time that whether I change my profession or do something to really make sure injury will be cut down. And then I had a water ski jacket in my home, and that material really seemed to be ideal for that. Then I found the factory in Texas, and I went there, and I told what I'm trying to do. He allowed me to really the design and try it out. That's how safety equipment started in early 1970, and then Mike Stone said he's doing that, and so I said, "Boy, I don't have time to fool with this. If you're doing, I'm going to stop." So he said, "Oh, thank you." And 6 months later, "Hey, Mike, how is your developing safety gear?" "Oh," he said, "I couldn't make it. You'd mind if I go back to my research then?" "No, you go ahead." That's how I restarted and made it possible.
And what year was that?
That was 1970.
I was officially the first person to wear it in Oklahoma. I think the first time I ever did splits, the first day I wore foot pads. But it was the adoption in that area of the country was a little unusual because many of the tournament promoters and the competitors felt they now had the opportunity to go full contact on concrete floors, and this is before you invented headgears. So I remember talking to Alan Steen, his first tournament with safety gear, which I competed in, but was he said there were 48 ambulance runs that day. So the unintended the unintended consequence early on was in the rough, tough, blood and guts guys not getting the idea this was to protect each other rather than to let each other hit each other harder.
Yeah. Well, I want to brag about what I did to really make martial art on the map. First of all, I introduced Taekwondo in this country, made it famous so that the world followed it. And of all, and when martial art is becoming a little bit slow because of danger, and then I invented safety gear. And I get comments from Kung Fu and Karate. I saved the martial arts. And then in 1985, when martial arts start closing down, because they don't know how to do the business. And so I started a business seminar, which you attended in 1985 at the Pat Burson's studio in Fort Worth, Texas, in July 4th, 1985. Do you remember?
I do.
Yeah, And that really made, paved the Cobar, and Sujin Lee and Ernie Rages, and they all made millionaires from that seminars. Many of them did. Dennis Brown and Kung Fu guy, Karate guy, and Taekwondo guy, they all did it. 2 years later, so many people who graduated from my seminar, they're starting business seminar.
Mm-hmm.
When I looked at, read about their textbook, is all mine.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're doing mine, I don't have to do it. I have so many other things to do, and so let them do the business seminar, and that really popularized martial art industry because they start making money.
Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
Absolutely. Well, if the school owners don't know how to develop their school, don't know how to fill it up with students, and don't have the financial resources, it's just impossible for them to expand, and impossible for them to provide the resources. You said that earlier, is that if you're not charging a reasonable tuition, you can't have resources. The example I like to use is Harvard, and part of the reason that they're so highly ranked is they have a large endowment, and they have strong, the highest professor salaries in the world, and they have the biggest and best library in the world, and so forth. So they have the top resources, both human and physical, for their students. So therefore, they can provide one of the highest quality educational experiences.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard to do that without those resources.
What do you go to Denver started?
1983. We just celebrated our 28-year anniversary.
Oh, you did? Okay. 1980.
Yeah.
Oh, really, time really flies, doesn't it?
Oh, it
well,
sure does.
Just seemed to be yesterday when I met you, 10 years old. That's really... So you stayed in Washington how many years? 4 years?
I was in Washington 1982 and early 83, and then and transferred to Georgetown as into my junior year. So I had ended up about 2.5 years at Georgetown, and of course working for you as an instructor and branch manager the entire time. And then with your help and Jeff Smith's help, who is permanently muted on this call right now, I apologize, Grandmaster Smith, put together, I think you remember, the 250-page business plan that I had put together.
Mm.
And at the time, I had a partner lined up who I projected I needed $50,000 to get started, and he bailed out. So I had a pocket full of credit cards, and my parents loaned me $10,000, and then I opened 5 schools in 18 months, ended up with about 1,500 students. Again, just modeling what you and Jeff and Nick and Ned and so forth had taught me.
I agree. That's a real success story.
Yeah, well, and now we're all over the world. So looking at Mile High Karate is going to be growing quickly this year. We've been kind of paring down the last 18 months, but now we're on a growth curve. So we currently have the number one school in Australia and the number one school in New Zealand, and certainly the number one school in Fresno and Central California, and the training facility there in Northern Virginia with Jeff Smith. So ready to roll all over the place. But let's go back and give everybody two or three bits of advice here. When you really are talking to parents about the outcome of martial arts instruction, what are some key points that you like to relay that their children are going to accomplish in martial arts and the way that they should think about it?
Well, the main thing is that, you know, I discuss, you know, why do you know why you are living? And, what's the difference between a man living without knowing where he's going and the plane flying without destination? And then energy is really out and then really collapsed from the, you know, crashing to the ground. That's the way human life ended, you know, ever since human history began, because we did not know why we are living. He says simply is that we are here to be happy. So in order to be, now we have the purpose of life, happiness. Now the values are determined by the purpose, right? When you have a watch, if you don't know the purpose, you don't have a value of a watch. By the same token, you know, because life's purpose is happiness, when are we finding the happiest moment? Love, when you share love. Love is the number one universal value. Why do I love my beautiful wife? Because she's beautiful. So beauty is the second value. And then there are two kinds of beauty. One is heart beauty. There's a skin beauty. What's more important? Heart beauty. Skin beauty can be fixed with Mary Kay or Avon, but what is the cosmetic for heart? Truth. That's why truth, beauty, and love. And when I am truthful, my heart is beautiful. My heart is beautiful. People love me. When people love me, I am happy. But we are living opposite of these values, evil values. When I cheat, my heart becomes ugly. When my heart is ugly, people hate me. I'm miserable. So I just defined what's the good, what's the really evil values, what's the good values. I just defined the definition of good and evil. Truth, beauty, and love are good values. And cheating and ugliness and hatred is evil values. And so, you know, I said, you know, when you so far we have been saying you have to be good for the become good, the sake of a good, being good. But now I am saying, you know, to be happy, you have to be good. That's a lot more incentive in teaching our children to be good. Oh, then when children say, when parents say to the children, you have to be good, Moses will say, yes, ma'am. But some smart boy, I ask, Mom, what's good? Don't have answer to that question. His mom say, you want to be happy, you want to be miserable. You want to be happy. You want to be good, you want to be bad. Oh, now this child knows why he has to be good for his own happiness. And this is the thing. Then, you know, we're talking about, you know, becoming, you know, Harvard A straight A students. I think our goal should be even higher than that. Our goal should be making our children literally saint, divine human character at a young age. You know, how would we do that? I have three golden rules of teaching our children, teachers or parents. Number one, parents and teacher must lead by example. Two, never fail to correct their mistakes with a smile. Not with not until they learn, but until they develop a habit. No matter how many time it takes, same, you know, mistakes, correction, same number of mistakes. You have to really deal with the smiling, and pretty soon the children will admire parents. And continue to lead by example. So the rules of teaching to become a is one, lead by example. Never fail to correct their mistakes with a smile. Not until they learn, but until they develop habit. Once they develop habit, it's very hard to undo. And then number three, continually lead by example. These are the things that I am really sharing with my parents, the children.
And you said something that I've always thought was essential, is in teaching character development and leadership in a martial arts school, is so many school owners try to script out a little paragraph that the instructor reads in front of the class. But what I've always felt is that the instructor has to be the embodiment of what those outcomes are. And frankly, the purpose of the reading and the purpose of being involved with your teachings and so forth is so the students are modeling a person who is what they want to be. And ultimately, parents know, either subliminally or consciously, that if the instructor doesn't embody those traits, then they don't want their child to be there.
That's right. So that's why, lead by example, action is the really core message to change the world. And I say, you know, you heard the expression, a picture is worth 1,000 words. And I added to that, an action is worth 1,000 pictures.
Yeah. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Well, Grandmaster, it's been very, very, very enlightening. let's make sure that we talk a little bit about your book. We're gonna make it available to all the schools and to all of the students across the world. And perhaps to just give them an action step is all the school owners will be getting information about how to buy it in quantity, but the retail link within the next week or so will be.
The four books in the box, they can buy one box for $310 or $12.
Yeah.
Then when they sell 25 each, that's about around almost $600 worth. So they have almost 90% profit.
Perfect, perfect. And for retail, we'll have the link over to your website. That's not quite up, but we'll have it at both milehighkarate.com and also have it at martialartsprofessional.com, so that they'll be able to get easy access to it, and all the school owners will be getting information on wholesale directly, and we'll have that both in the owner section for Mile High Karate and in the owner section for NAMNA members. So, if you don't mind, Grandmaster Ree, if you're up to it, let's open the line up a little, take everybody off mute, and do some Q&A, if that's okay.
Oh, sure.
Okay. See if I can get... So we should have... There we go. So... Everybody should be off mute, so anybody who has any questions of Grandmaster Ree, anything at all, I'm sure he'd be happy to answer. So, and Grandmaster Smith, we should actually be able to hear you now. I apologize for having you on mute.
Can you hear me now?
Our software system wasn't trying to let you speak. But and perhaps now that we have Grandmaster Smith with us, Grandmaster Ree is... you two have a long history, not that, and we do too, but Grandmaster Smith, what year did you start training under Grandmaster Ree?
I started in 1964 in Kingsville, Texas, at one of Grandmaster Ree's satellite schools back then, with one of his black belts from the University of Texas was a big guy by the name of Bruce Turner. He was 6'7", about 260 pounds, and he was an art major of all majors for such a big guy, and he was from Kingsville, but he was attending the University of Texas, and actually back then, he was one of June Ree's black belts, and started a summer program over in Kingsville, and... that continued on with some of the other instructors after he went back to the University of Texas.
He sounds like David Harrelson. You know, our instructors in Tulsa were Greg Mulder, Grant Mulder, Bob Ellinghaus, David Harrelson. David Harrelson was probably 6'4", 280 pounds, and was a concert pianist who was within a fraction of an inch of getting into Juilliard to study piano. So it's interesting. Again, Grandmaster, you had quite the storied group of students. Jeff Smith certainly being one of the preeminent among them. But Grandmaster Smith, your record was the top point fighter in the world, and then the first world light heavyweight kickboxing champion, and frankly, Don King's first and only heavyweight kickboxing champion with that event on the Muhammad Ali undercard.
Yeah, exactly. Jeff Smith, you remember that time? You know, I spent $9,000 to build that ring.
Yeah.
Oh, so that was a long time ago. It was a lot of money that time, but I didn't really, regret that I spent money to promote martial art. That was one of the greatest promotional event on the Don King show. On the same card as Muhammad Ali's fight.
It still holds the record for the largest.
I was glad that you won that one.
Yeah, it still holds the record for the largest viewing audience of a live karate event with over 50 million people viewing that.
Yeah, that was phenomenal. That was for those who are too young to remember, which is most everybody else on the call. That was one of the most clamored for rematches in history.
What year was that?
That was in 75.
What year
that fight was? 1975. Huh? In 75.
That's what I thought, yes. Uh-huh.
And well, what a lot of people might not know about Grandmaster Rhee, when you first came to this country, you were at San Marcos, Southwest Texas State, and then you transferred over to University of Texas, and your degree was in engineering, wasn't it, Master Rhee?
I studied civil engineering, but in fact, in 1962, I went to Washington for summer job. I still needed 12 semester hours to really finish my degree in engineering. But I don't miss it because I got about two, three honorary doctorate from Korea.
The innovations that you made in the martial arts, far surpass anybody that's, in the martial arts community, both in this country or outside of this country. But the way you changed the history of martial arts, not just with your musical ballet, musical forms, but also integrated one of the first modern systems, and some people call it American Taekwondo, some people call it modern style versus traditional style, but one of the first ones to really see that some of the old style and practical application didn't work as well, and made changes not just to the application of techniques, but even to the modern forms that you put together.
Yeah, I think the safety gear really, but also practical training. Which Richie really developed to be full contact fight with the equipment on. And I really don't like to see that ultimate fighting because it's too brutal for me.
And I don't think everybody really understands the impact that the safety equipment really, I think everybody just takes it for granted that equipment was around, but once you invented it, there were several other companies that infringed upon your patents, and you had so many different patents on that you could have put them all out of business but actually helped them because you wanted the martial arts community to have the safety factor to expand.
I never sued let them develop.
I know there's a lot of companies out there that are still thriving and are successful that started by either you were making their equipment for them and then they went off and did it themselves, or they followed your pattern or your style and made a version of it. But
I knew all that going on, but I never sued anybody.
I know.
Yeah.
And even with the evolution, and I'm saying evolution because when you first made that equipment, you didn't make it for the reason to have full contact or knockout karate. You did it for the safety factor, but it eventually evolved into that because people now could go full out without getting severely injured having a good set of rules, and it started another whole competition was the foundation and the beginning of the even the mixed martial arts today.
That's right,
And certainly for developing martial arts instruction and developing professional schools, it was essential. Since that safety factor before, there was certainly in the Texas-Oklahoma element, there was quite the high injury factor. And if with that kind of injury factor, it's hard to keep people long term, and it's hard to get them to bring their friends in.
And Grandmaster Lee's whole style of mechanics of motion and movement also proved itself in the ring, because once we got into the full contact, you could really see the full potential of the techniques. And, you know, at one time in our Jinri instructors who came up from white belts in the Jinri system, we had either the world champion or the number one contender in every weight class except heavyweight. And that's only because we didn't have a heavyweight back then. We didn't have anybody that was fighting on our team a heavyweight. But from super lightweight, world champions was Gordon Frank. And then the number one contender in the lightweight was Michael Coles. He was the U.S. champion. And the number one contender in middleweight and the U.S. champion was Rodney Batiste. And then the light heavyweight world champion, of course, was me. And we didn't have a heavyweight. So four out of the five weight classes were held by Jinri black belts, either world champion. We had two out of the five world champions and two more out of the five that were number one contenders and U.S. champion. And on top of that, just besides having the top fighting, he also produced the top forms people in the country that dominated the national circuit for years, you know, including John Chung and Charlie Lee and Helen Chung. Say that again, Master Lee?
Carmichael Simon, exactly.
Yeah, Carmichael Simon. And it wasn't, you know, just a bunch of, you know, physical fighting stuff. You really embodied your philosophy of strength, power with the beauty. Back then, you had to have the application because we had the control and the point fighting. We had the top team. You know, we won Alan Steen's tournament that year that you went down there and performed our Washington, D.C. team with Pat Worley and the rest of the guys and myself, won that U.S. Alan Steen's team championship, and that was against the Chuck Norris teams and the Texas teams and the Midwest teams. And back then, there was so many teams from all different parts of the country. It was a very competitive competition, and we won that point competition too. So it's been something that in every phase of the martial arts field, Grandmaster Lee has excelled with his students.
Absolutely. And anybody who wants to chip in and ask Grandmaster Lee any questions, feel free. Grandmaster, I recently read an interesting book. I don't know if you've actually read it or not. You were interviewed quite extensively for it. It's called A Killing Art, The Untold History of Taekwondo. Alex Gillis. Have you had a chance to read that one?
No, I haven't.
It's quite interesting. It's purported to be the behind the scenes history of the development of Taekwondo, and frankly, it's you come across as the shining ethical star among quite an interesting cast of underworld characters in the development of the art, to tell you the truth. Yeah, quite the interesting behind the scenes machinations, both between North and South Korea and Chae Hong Hai and many of the others. So it's interesting. I don't know how accurate it is. It'd probably be interesting to get your take on it all. And I guess he had interviewed you. Alex Gillis had interviewed you quite extensively. But again, of all the characters in the book, you come across as the shining example of truth, honesty, and beauty in a world of duplicity and egomania.
I never seen the book.
I'll get you a copy and have it sent to you.
I like to read it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm surprised, you know, since you were he interviewed you to contribute to it, that he wouldn't at least have the decency to send you an autographed or a copy of it so you can see what he actually wrote versus what you said.
Yeah. I will tell you, most of the other characters other than Grandmaster read in the book. Yeah, if you're mentioned briefly, but most of the other characters in the book wouldn't have wanted to see the book. So Taekwondo and martial arts in general in the United States has had quite the cast of characters over the years.
Just like any other martial art, they've had, you know, there's good and bad in every field.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's always interesting to see the reality versus the legend and the, you know, the thing that's impressive about Grandmaster Ri, in comparison with many that I have met, is the fact that you've always stood on the same principles for my relationship now goes back to 1969 and Jeff's goes back to 64. So they've always stood on the same principles for that many years now.
We know what
and how martial art spread throughout the world, and I'm proud of playing a really major part of that happening, and I will continue to do. You know, because when I think of it, what I used to be, a really timid young boy, and became a father of U.S. Taekwondo and USSR. And if I could do that, maybe next step should be changing the whole world. That's how the Trutopia came into my picture.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, nothing like having small goals, Grandmaster Ri.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Another thing, I don't know that if everybody knows about Grandmaster Ri also is that you know, not only is he an American citizen, but one of the most patriotic Americans in this country. And, you know, he's been teaching on Capitol Hill with the congressman there for, is that 40-something years now, Master Ri?
I cannot hear you. What did you say? What's the question?
I was saying... Since 1965. Yeah, he was. We have kind of an interesting connection there, but he was talking about your level of patriotism, Master Ri, and you had mentioned earlier you've been teaching the U.S. Congress for free since 1965.
The reason I did it, another reason is because hope of a better world in the future is U.S. Without U.S., it's impossible.
Yeah.
Why I really admire U.S. and I really value this country so much for the hope of really contributing to bring the Trutopian society into humanity.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, let's do this. If anybody has any questions, feel free to chime in here, and we'll need to wrap up in a couple minutes. So, anybody have any questions for Grandmaster Ri before we ring off? No?
Is everybody unmuted?
Go ahead.
Is everybody unmuted?
Yes, they are. They are now, although a lot of times they have a mute delay on their end.
Okay. I would like to hear Grandmaster Ri's his workout regime. You know, part of his rule by example, you know, at his 80 years age now, he is doing a routine of working out that, you know, people that in their 20s would have trouble keeping up with. Could you share with everybody what your daily workout routine is, Grandmaster?
As I have that June daily dozen, that's about 30 minutes. And then I do push-ups and sit-ups and stretching. I do about around 1 hour daily. When I go three times a week for the Congress, there I work out there. But when I don't go, still I do in my home. You know, and today we have a DVD. Very easy to do home study. In fact, I am really trying to do a home study course through DVD future when time comes.
Absolutely. Hey, and we've mentioned Congress quite a few times. You've had some fairly famous politicians through your program as well. If I remember, Newt Gingrich and our current vice president.
And Bob Livingston. Bobby Ross, Jesse Jackson Jr., Mike Espy, quite a few. We have produced about 20 black belts last 45 years.
So
Congress have 20 black belts. That's a lot,
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, fantastic. Well, we were going to have to wrap up and not monopolize any more of your time, Grandmaster Reed.
Let me say one thing that, you know, I titled my Trutopian book, Taekwondo Philosophy. The reason I did that is because the seven qualities of a champion, that really opened my eyes to a purpose of life and how we can really change the world for good. And so when they buy the book, I think it's Seven Qualities of a Champion is the reason how I developed this Trutopian philosophy.
Absolutely. And that merits us spending quite a bit of time one time again here on going through the seven qualities of the champion, how that applies to martial arts instruction. So let's put that on our agenda for getting another recording for everybody to share that with them.
Okay.
Well, very good. Well, thank you, Grandmaster Ree, and
thank you,
Grandmaster Smith.
Opportunity to really promote this book so that we can really bring the human society a much better place to live for our future generations.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Grandmaster Ree, thank you for your inspiration today and your time.
Okay, guys. I'll let everybody go. Have a good day. I'll talk to you on your one-to-one calls.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. See you guys.